You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I think he's created a poor education on how to make good content.
This week on Unbox, I'm speaking to Hayden Hillier-Smith. Hayden has edited for some of the biggest creators in the world, ranging from Mr. Beast to Logan Paul and so many others. If I'm starting out, what is the size of the prize?
A good starting salary for an editor is probably,
how do I even get my first client? How did you get to this position of being really one of the foremost editors in the world?
I wasn't able to be on the side of Logan during his meteoric rise. I thought he was just a short-term job.
We're going to talk about all of these things and so much more, so let's get into it with Hayden Hillier. I personally believe that Creator Inc., so the Mr. Beast of the world, the Cybermans of the world, the phase before their collapse, you know, those creators who transcended pre-TikTok, pre-COVID, had a much deeper level of connection and an ability to build an audience that was far deeper than anything that came post-COVID, post-TikTok. And as a result, they are the equivalent to the Bob Dylans, the Michael Jacksons of this space, which has evolved that quickly.
Yeah.
Where they're like legacy, but they are so big that they will have value in a way forever in terms of a brand. But for anyone coming through now, is it even possible to get to that level in any sector, whether it's music or creators, or is it just going to be different?
I think around our time, it was only a few of us had the privilege to be able to start being creators. But now everyone has that opportunity. And I think actually that's a blessing and its curse. I think one of the best things today is that now everyone can be a creator. But one of the worst things today is that everyone can be a creator. And so just that sheer volume, and then also what is standard, what is considered meta in today's landscape, I think has such diminishing value or doesn't have as good of a deeper level connection, because of course, I think they're in a little bit more of a competitive market where it's like us with the Cybermen or with my experience with Logan, we were posting like every single day and we had the privilege of 10 minute vlogs every single day to really generate that deeper value. And what's the only good way that you can develop a good relationship? Time. We don't, some of the creators who are trying to get popular today don't have that luxury of time to develop. It's because it would be smart to try to get popular today on TikTok or on YT Shorts, but you can't develop a relationship in a minute. You can't really go deep into something in a minute. You can't really express yourself on that deeper level that we had the luxury of too, because even at that time, I would say our time, we're getting old. We weren't in as of a competitive market because I think also everyone says attention spans. I don't think that's correct. I think our bullshit meter's gotten better.
Yeah.
And we now know that we can find better content easier. And so we're less forgiving on bad videios.
100% agree.
And a lot of these new creators, I empathize in the fact that they are in a much more competitive industry because so many more people are choosing this as a career, and audience viewing habits are a lot more aggressive. And so it means that, again, it's harder to, because of that, harder to develop a relationship online today.
Couldn't agree more. And even if you think about the sheer volume of content that we would have seen at 18 years old versus an 18-year-old today, how many videos, just in terms of your, as you say, that BS meter of like inefficient, not good enough, the standard that's been set really since TikTok and the short form takeover of attention, or the dominance of short form on attention, has meant that, as you say, it's so brutal. You have to be, I mean, and all of us have to do that. Anyone who's making content, anyone who's working with creators, there is still that need now to optimize so much more, to make everything so much more refined to that really that high standard that's now been set by audiences that seems to just be going like this and this and this.
I think our ability to make content better was something that we weren't really capable of doing a couple of years ago. And so you're right, our quality of content has improved. I would love, like, imagine the concept of, like, of what the Sidemen were doing 5 years ago. And imagine if they got a time machine and then you showed them 5 years ago, this is the content you're going to be doing in 5 years. Would they have even imagined that? Could they have even believed it? No way. And imagine maybe 6-7 years ago, hey, KSI, you're going to be fighting Tommy Fury in a couple of years' time. He went, bullshit. That wouldn't happen. Yeah. But it has. But that's because we've had the experience and improved the storytellers. And so, again, I think just the quality expected on web media wasn't as high then. Yeah. That quality of us as filmmakers today, that standard of hire is so much higher that it will take a new creator quite a few years to even consider themselves having that talent of ability just yet. Whereas I think a lot of us, essentially, we could be crap filmmakers right from the get-go.
We've jumped right in.
I love that.
This is great.
This is the best thing. I like podcasts like this, like just value straight away.
Well, I realize you do that in all your videos, right? So I've obviously been, I love your content, by the way. And I think even though I'm not an editor, I'm fascinated by how you do what you do and how well and how you know what it is. It's similar to, like, you know when you see a producer and they're making music live in a studio, and you see like the videos of Timbaland, right? And he's making his tracks with Kanye West or whoever, Jay-Z in the studio, and you just see that you know, the wisdom and the brilliance and the experience just shine through in like 10 seconds. It's like, wow. And you do that so well in everything that you do. For those who don't know, and we'll keep it brief, obviously, for all the things we've been saying about stories, but how did you get to this position of being really one of the foremost editors in this space in the world?
Something that I've been thinking about a lot, like how it's, there was this case where I think my career just took off very suddenly, without warning. And then only really recently in the past year or two have I suddenly woken up and went, what the hell just happened? And so I'm beginning to look back a lot on a lot of this. And I think the best way to describe it is a lot of people say luck isn't a factor in this career, where I actually disagree. I think luck is a huge factor. But what people avoid or don't realize is that your ability and talent to answer to that luck. And I think for me, I was very fortunate that I'd already had developed a lot of really good talent and ability. Quite arrogant when you say, yeah, I've developed talent. It's quite arrogant. I developed my ability to then, when the opportunity came for me to then work with Logan Paul, I passed through that interview stage like as one of the best, and me and Logan started working through. And then I was unable to be on the side of Logan during his meteoric rise. But the interesting thing always was that I thought he was just a short-term job. As like, I just got fired from another job, and I was like, all right, fine, I worked for Logan for 6 months. He's just that ex-Vine star. I don't give a shit about him. But then I just saw that meteoric rise, and also it wasn't a particularly great fit. Why would some British kid work with some jock from Ohio whose favorite things is going to the gym and American football, whereas my end of evenings is watching an episode of Fawlty Towers?
Did you show Logan Fawlty Towers ever?
I think once he didn't care. I don't know. But it was because of those two things. I'd already had developed my ability as a creator, as an editor, as a filmmaker, and then answered the call for when luck finally answered to me. But this wasn't the career path I actually expected myself to go. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to put movies in the cinema, put it on TV. That was always kind of my aspiration. And then my life went in this direction. I went, all right, let's go.
Yeah.
And so I think because of that, I've always treated editing in that way. Like, I'm editing a YouTube video, but I edit it in a way as if I'm expecting this to be put on something in a cinema. I've always treated it way too seriously.
Yeah.
And then because I always had that attitude, I think it then meant that I was constantly developing that muscle of seeing YouTube in that way.
Mm.
And so when the time finally came, when around 2020, when I was ready in my own personal confidence and my own ability, that I feel ready to talk about this online. And I think what it was is because I saw a gap in the market. I grew up watching The Apprentice, and they always say, what's the gap in the market? Yeah.
What's the USP?
Yeah, what's your... And so I was like, and I always hated that editing tutorials was how to do this effect on After Effects. Here's how you can do this transition. Here's how you can create this LUT. And I went, this is so boring and this is not what editing is to me. And so I finally popped my head out of the sand and said, this is what editing is to me. It's storytelling. It's making people care. It's getting emotional reactions out of people. It's here's how you can make sure that they are engaged on an emotional level rather than, let's say, like hijacking their brains with like over-the-top effects. Here's how you can make your content actually work. And the world went, finally, someone's talking about this. And I think that's why so quickly, I think within 6 months of me starting it, I already got a video of 1 million views. Now, granted, I had Logan Paul in the thumbnail, and so I did a little bit of social hacking there.
But as we know, it's not enough.
It's not enough. But I think people then tuned in because of my personality and the perspective, and so I did the social hacking, but then people stayed because they loved my perspective on it all. That's where a lot of people fail with their social hacking videos.
Yeah.
But I think but we'll talk about that in maybe a little bit. Yeah. But, and so, and then because of that, people just tuned in and were really enjoyed. And I think, yeah, I spotted a gap in the market. I did some social hacking and I waited for the right time. I didn't actually rush any of this. I could have done this 6-7 years ago, but I didn't even feel like I was ready then. It was only around 2020 and I was like, I feel like now is the time for me to talk of what I've wanted to say online for years.
Because I guess one thing that that really hooked me about everything that you talk about is you're going against the grain, mm-hmm. and I think you seem to have always gone against the grain by bringing in some more traditional filmmaking techniques into everything that you do, but also looking at editing for YouTube and treating it like it's up here and giving it the respect that I think it deserves. It's not all about hacking attention. It's actually about giving people something meaningful and an emotional connection. I mean, what would you say is your philosophy to editing?
I think the best answer to that is that because YouTube editing didn't exist when I was developing myself as a filmmaker, that's why the only thing I could learn was traditional. But then I already learned straight away that if I was to be making these films on YouTube, that's a completely different ballgame. And so that's why I started thinking about it in that sense. And so for me, I always had approached my attitude of modernizing traditional film and making it work with web media today. And so that's how I've always thought about it. And it's because, and the reason why I stand by that a lot is that I think film and Hollywood has already existed for 100 years. They've gone through a lot of their mistakes themselves and they've been developing and figuring out how they can tell the best stories. And so they figured this out. They know what to do. All we didn't have to do is read their books, talk to the right people, understand their philosophies and go, well, here's how we can update it. And the best example always will be, you know, most films probably start with an establishing shot. Why the hell would you do that on a YouTube video? As soon as you get an establishing shot, I'm out.
Swipe.
Yeah, swipe. And so you have to be aware of where you can modernize filmmaking. But they've already made some of the best pieces of media to ever exist. So why are we neglecting this? Except we need to embrace how we can modernize it. And the bottom line, their priority is always story. Their priority is always character. Their priority is always emotion. One of the most biggest editors in Hollywood history is Walter Murch. And he always talks about these. He has 6 rules of editing, but the top 3 he always mentions, it is emotion, story, and rhythm. And he always bases a lot of his editing choices on that. Where I think today, a lot of editing techniques is focused on how to hack people's attention, how to hack people's, how to hack the algorithm, how to hijack I think people's minds. And I'm thinking, and then the amount of times that we do look at a lot of content today where that probably has happened, there has been times when a video has been so loud and bombastic and so much has been going on, so much that it does hijack my brain, the video's over, and I went, well, what just happened? And turns out actually nothing happened. It probably just hijacked my brain, and quite frankly I didn't consent to that. And so I think that's why for me, I've been doubling down more on my priorities that I imagine content or editing should be, which is emotion, story, and rhythm. And a lot of that is informing on characters. It is helping us guide us into emotions. And a lot of that is coming from traditional. But I am also aware that, of course, as I've said, it has to be modernized. And so I'm kind of like a centrist on it, where I can understand I'm being a slightly conservative about filmmaking, but then also then being very maybe on the other side liberal on okay, what is probably the new modern ideas? And I try to find that place in the middle. And I think a lot of people really enjoy that.
I'm sure in the editing, I'm not in it, right? But in the editing community, there's a lot of purists who are like, no, this is not the right way. And there's a lot of people who say, no, make it entirely progressive and hack, hack, hack. And I guess it's fighting the temptation to go for the views and the metrics that are big and bombastic and exciting when the depth and the substance isn't maybe there. And actually, to the point on connection, if more of editing was focused on emotion, storytelling and rhythm and giving back to the viewer rather than just trying to manipulate their brain, essentially, how much more connection could be formed with this new cohort of creative talent?
Well, it goes into, I think, one of my favorite philosophies was from Ryan Trahan, where he goes into redemptive content, where I think he likes to imagine his videos as a gift to his viewers. I've made something for you, and let me give this to you, and you can enjoy it, whatever you want with it. And I'm not expecting anything in return. I just made this for you, and let me give this to you. Whereas I think a lot of videos today are built to take. Like, let me sell you this product. Let me do this, and so you can get me 10 million views because I want that validation. And I think it comes down to just the intent, the core intent of why you've made this video. And I think I also learned that with my experience with Logan, in the sense that we were making videos every single day and Logan was giving his entire day towards his viewers with these daily vlogs and even with the 2020 vlogs. And I think people really, really enjoyed that. They were a great gift. But in the middle of them, he went and buy my Maverick merch. But it wasn't the whole video. It was just like, hey, I've given you something great. And if you want, you can buy some Maverick
merch. If you want, buy this Maverick. But it was always, and I remember those vlogs so well, because who doesn't remember that period where the growth was obviously on top of the world, you guys were just killing it. And it was a meme. He made it so funny that it was like Maverick, Maverick, Maverick. But it wasn't in a way that ever felt exploitative. It was like funny and self-aware.
It was meta. Yeah. It was like he was very aware of like, hey, this is the peak of the vlog. Buy Maverick merch.
Yeah, exactly. It was part of the content, right?
Yeah, it was part of the content. It was the joke of like, hey, I'm in this capitalist society where I have to make money somehow. Let me buy Mario Match. Like he was aware of the joke that, but the priority was 90% of the video was a gift, and I think that's why I think a lot of people resonated with the Maverick idea, because it wasn't forced. It was kind of made fun of that it had to be there, but the message was still really strong. Be a Maverick. Like go when everyone goes right, you go left. It is like be confident in yourself. On like, hey, you don't believe you can achieve this? Put on a Maverick hoodie and you can achieve this. Like that idea was quite powerful. Yeah. But then also making fun of, I have to fund this. It's like, it still worked in both. He was able to achieve, he was able to have his cake and eat it too. And that's very rare.
Yeah, but also I think partly wise, because he walked the walk in sacrificing his life to it.
Yeah.
So because people could see he was giving everything over to this whole vlogging commitment of daily vlogs, you kind of, regardless of who you are, where you are, you respect the hustle. You go, wow, you're really giving everything. You're not just trying to outsource everything to 100 people. You are front and center, showing up every single day. And almost the admiration to go, how do you even make that work in your life? And then for people to look at the, you're selling Maverick, but actually you're investing in the crazy experiences that make the content better and better. So actually, weirdly, people end up paying him, and obviously there's profit on top and everything else commercially, but they're paying him to increase the value of the content. It's like the most genius thing ever. I remember it was like top of the world.
Fantastic,
incredible.
Positive loop. I think you have to make sure that that when you're selling a product, you have to have a positive loop towards it. And so buying that helped Logan create better content, and we feel that improvement. Like you are encouraged to probably buy another hoodie or something like that. It was a really fantastic positive loop.
Yeah, 100%. Right, so I want to take this time with you, very precious time with you, to provide, on this point of giving, right, to provide something for the kid out there who is maybe 17 years old, you when you were 17, maybe a bit younger even, and you're looking at somebody like yourself now who is just, you know, taking on this space and really leading it from the front. And trying to give this time to that person to help them, as we were talking about responsibility, to help them to at least get the blueprint for what's to come and how they can make a success of this. So I'm going to imagine myself as that person. Firstly, what is the size of the prize for editors? So what is the commercial prospect? And what is the potential? What can be made? What can be done commercially for you or for an individual?
That's an interesting question. Commercially, as in like maybe even financially?
Financially, from a business perspective. If I'm starting out, what is the size of the prize? Like, what can this look like for me?
Okay, I would say One of the interesting observations I've made recently is that I think because this is a new industry, a good creator is smart enough in respecting their editor. And so a good starting salary for an editor is probably a couple years into the game, is able to actually competently do a job without that much guidance. You can imagine starting your career at about 50,000 a year, even as a starting place. But then as you then get more experience and become a bit more reliable and I hate this phrase, like irreplaceable, you can start pushing your salary to probably about 120 to 150 a year. But then if then becomes in a place that you can get really, really talented in a way that this creator can genuinely only make their videos with you, and maybe you start managing a team as well, that can be between the 250 to 300 a year. And then there's even some people that I know that are on 500 a year now because they are genuinely irreplaceable.
And they're managing big units.
But also teams, managing teams. But then on top of that, and this is still relatively new, and it doesn't even happen in Hollywood yet, editors can also then get residuals, which residuals in Hollywood is if a show does well, if it had a bunch of advertisement in it, that show has made money, you get a percent of that. And there are some editors that I know that have like 10, 20% of the AdSense from the creator. And so it's such a great incentivization. If I need to make sure this video goes as viral as possible, I need to make sure it's as engaging as possible, so therefore more ads are shown, the video makes more money, I get paid more. And then what that also then helps keep, in the creator's mind, it helps the editor stay in their umbrella, basically, because we're also in a very, very competitive market. That's why these high salary creator editors are our debate of demand so much, is because actually this creator is trying to buy that person out, trying to like hijack, trying to steal that editor. And so we're in this great advantage on that top 1%. But as I said, editors, it can go from starting 50,000 all the way up to 250 to maybe even 500 a year.
Yeah. And to your point, incentivization for everything, I think now it is so much more important than ever to have that deeper level of, you know, you're aligned with me. And actually, I think it shows, to your point, some people out there making 10, 20%, whatever it might be, just how important editors are to the channel.
Yeah.
And I even see it with obviously the Cyberman operation, just how important, for example, with Dylan, a Chip Fat is to the whole thing. And you can see their touch on everything. And without those people, it doesn't work.
Yeah. I can feel the Chip Fat stamp.
Yeah.
Like, I
can
feel like he edited like that. That's very much his staple. That's exactly how he would do it. It's like, I just love those types of experiences. Then it becomes part of the character.
Yeah.
I think editors have a lot more creative freedom. You know, the best example for me is every time Logan would do something silly, instead of putting like trap music or hip hop beats music underneath, I would do Beethoven. And I think that then became part of the character. And so I had the opportunity to really use my character in the editing that then represented Logan. And so, yeah, I think it's the editing is now part of the character in these channels.
Yeah, well, that's one thing that I've definitely learned and seen. Chip Fat's a good example. You're obviously an amazing example. Just how funny you have to, not to, you know, be like, oh, I'm really funny, but just how funny you have to be to be an editor, how much you need to, and that's the secret sauce. It's how much can you inject more editorial quality, more laughs, more dynamism in, and that's the bit that people don't really appreciate. It's not line cutting, it's storytelling, and not just storytelling, but really like comedy in every moment. How can you inject something new into it? That's what differentiates, right? So if I'm that kid again, that 17, 18 year old, how do I get to that point? How do I get good at those things? Because that's almost a bit intangible, right?
I think it comes into, there's two things there. One, with my generation as filmmakers, we grew up with Edgar Wright and Scott and his movies like Scott Pilgrim and Hot Fuzz. And he then popularized the idea of meta editing, like self-aware editing. And that idea has then rippled across the next generation. And now they're really going like 200% with that stuff.
What is that for people who don't know?
I think it is just, I think prior to that, editing had to be invisible. Like clearly this was, if a video or if a TV show was clearly edited, it's like, how dare you? It was absolute blasphemy. But now editing is, this was clearly edited by someone and they have their stamp. It's like someone does something very undramatic and you put the most epic music underneath.
Yeah. Like, I always think of like Arrested Development.
Yeah.
Did that really well. And like, obviously like The Office. Right?
Yeah.
Did that really well in terms of just adding those sprinkles of over the top, or as you say, meta editing, which added comedic effect to everything.
Yeah, and I think I think that's a really great example, exactly. And I think that is probably what I imagine in terms of So that's probably the modern style of editing. Like, this was clearly edited by someone, and you can kind of put your stamp on it. You kind of put your perspective. You can kind of put your idea of how to make this work. So you can clearly say, this was edited, and I'm not trying to be invisible here. And I think that trend, and I love that trend, I love that idea, and I think it's still, and I think I'm so happy that that is still a popular idea today.
Yeah, for sure. And how do you start getting good?
Time and experience. It's a classic thing. It is, I think I'm trying to think of this non-anecdotally. I think even when I was younger, I knew I couldn't get good overnight. I had to be patient. And so it was a typical case where, for me, I did just start doing whatever it is that I could do by myself in terms of making my own videos, getting my neighbors to just help hold the camera and things like that. And then also then finding friends who are at a similar skill level as me. I think I see a lot of people make that same mistake where it's like, yeah, I want to be an editor. And then they start contacting me. Hey, I'll work for you. Whereas, like, what experience did you have? Oh, I've done this for a week. When then I can't hire you. But I think if you're a developing creator, find people who are at the same skill level and then grow up together. Mr. Beast talks about that a lot, where he used to be on Skype calls every single day, or Discord calls every single day with people. Like, hey, what did you learn today? What did you learn today? I think another great example recently is a creator named Jenny Hoyos. She got really popular in shorts, and now she's doing really great long form videos. And it was because she then found a group of people at the same skill level as her, and then they grew up together. I think Sidemen is another great example. Like, they're all at the same skill level as presenters, as filmmakers, as comedians, and they all developed their skills together, and they're all still best mates. So that's actually a fantastic example. Sidemen's a great example. Like, not one of them was like the number one talent straight away. It was like they all were at the same skill level, and then they grew up together. I think that's the best thing to do. You have to be able to find the people at the same skill level as you and grow up together.
Yeah. And let's say I do that and I start making a little community of people, then what's the next step? Like, should I go to film school?
No. But yes. But no, but yes. It's, I think going to film school now is an incredibly nuanced discussion. I would say the best example is 2012, I went to university, and it was a film school university, and they did digital films.
No, Ravensbourne, right?
Ravensbourne.
Which is obviously in this country and in London especially, like, one of the best,
yes.
I think, in the space.
I think it absolutely is. Ravensbourne is still one of the best.
It's a bit creepy. I was like, you went to Ravensbourne. So.
But at the time, though, during my first week there, at one of the first ever lectures there, the lecturer asked, what do you guys want to be? I want to be a cinematographer. I want to be a director. I want to be the next Christopher Nolan. I want to be the next Quentin Tarantino. I want to be the head of BBC in 20 years time. All great ambitions. Hayden, what do you want to be? I want to be a YouTuber. And I was laughed out of that lecture hall. It was like, people thought it was the most hilarious thing.
And you were dead serious.
And I was dead serious. Like, I think YouTube's going to be the next big thing. And I was laughed out of that room. But this was 2012. It was just starting to grab its feet. But I was also told, some of them said, oh yeah, Vimeo is going to take over in a year, because they were posting their short films on there. And they thought that's what audiences wanted.
Right.
So for me, that taught me that film schools are likely to be ever so slightly outdated. 2-3 years late, like, I think the next year, they actually then finally brought in someone who was highly experienced in YouTube and started teaching web media. And so I'm always aware of, they have to develop their curriculums, they have to develop their education, and that could take 2 to 3 years. And by the time they've perfected it, it's already outdated. But as I've talked about developing filmmakers and being surrounded by those right people, Ravensbourne provided that for me. And so I was unable to meet filmmakers that also had similar ambitions, similar ideas. They also agreed, hey, I actually think YouTube's going to be this next big thing. Let's work together. And then I met those people, and then all of us became really great filmmakers for web media because of that. Even though I'm entirely grateful for Ravensbourne, what they taught me was not relevant, was not important. But the people that I met there was highly important. And they also provided the right resources as well. And so the education wasn't great, but the resources and people was fantastic. And I think, but yeah, it's, and so it has to be, what are you looking for in film school?
Yeah.
But again, you can get film school anywhere now. Case in point, this channel, my channel, The Editing Podcast, Colin and Samir, everyone else who talks about education. Education is so much more accessible now that and you don't have to put yourself 30, 40, 50K in debt now.
Yeah.
And especially even in America, you have to put yourself a couple hundred thousand in debt. But then you can't finance you being yourself a creator because you've got to pay off that debt every month.
Yeah.
And so that is, I think, the big trade-off. And so I think I was probably maybe the last generation to really benefit from film school, whereas today, I think now you can get education everywhere.
Yeah, 100%. And as I really believe, there is no excuse to at least not have education today because it's all free and it's all on the internet. And if you can be on TikTok, scrolling for hours a day, clocking up 7-8 hours of screen time, you can teach yourself pretty much anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's say it starts working for me, right? I go to film school, maybe I don't, but I start coming out and I start getting a few clients. Well, firstly, how do I even get my first clients? Let's say I want to go down the freelance route. I don't want to go work in an agency or something. How do I actually start getting work in this space?
I think for me, I will be transparent. Since I have been in the privilege of, I can essentially ask anyone for a job nowadays, I'm trying to think of how could I get to this position today? And knowing that this position that I'm in took me up to 10 years to get to this point, I would say if I started now, it might even take a little bit longer. But if I was to start today, and let's say I did have these skills, I would probably have to take any job and just get more of those reps in. But then making sure that the people that I'm working with are giving me new experiences and things that I can learn from if I'm working for a client, because that client has also built themselves a career where they can afford an editor, which means they are having a bit of a more successful business and they might actually also know people. And then one day they're going to say, yeah, I've hired this great editor. And then one of their mates goes, oh, really? Oh,
I need a good editor.
I've been looking for an editor. And even though they're best mates, that guy's going to go, hey, how much is he paying you per month? Oh, he's paying me this month. I'll double it. And then suddenly that then person might give you maybe a new job. But part of my privilege of where I am today is because I committed to Logan for 8 years. I think I have to be honest.
Obviously, your case is quite specific, right? Because you had a marquee client. And I guess that's the point, though. If you do have a marquee client who is ascending, then do the best job you possibly can, smash out every day, every vlog, and then that'll take you up to this great point.
Yeah.
You know,
you can still get a great career with one person. You can get a great career with multiple people. You can get a great career hopping clients. I don't think there really is a right way. I think it's more so understanding and identifying opportunity and also enjoying the process and understanding how unpredictable this all is. Just be good at what you do, and then I think the universe will always respond positively.
Yeah, to your point, there was two things there that really stuck out to me. One is, and I know this because I've had people send me stuff and they'll be like, right, I've just edited a short for you. I've edited a video for you. I think you can make yours a bit better. What do you think? And they'll send it and you'll be like, hold on, they've invested their time in, they're confident enough to send something, to say that there are problems in something and that there's improvements that can be made. They'll send it, it'll be the best edited thing. You'll be like, whoa. And then you almost want to do everything you can to work with that person. And I think that is a marketing technique, and maybe we can get onto kind of marketing yourself, because it's obviously something that you've done brilliantly by creating your own personal brand. It's something that I'm a big believer in today. You must in any career, any profession, have a personal brand now. But the idea of being able to put yourself out there, take the time to do a trial edit for nothing, give it to them, that half a day it might have taken you to do that might be the best investment you ever make.
Yes, I absolutely agree. But also, have you also received 99% of those emails you've received have been terrible?
Yes.
And that
that was the second point of what you said, which was you have to be good.
Yeah, and to be good.
That is the number one thing, I think, in anything, right? But it sounds like from what you're saying, in editing, you have to just be amazing.
You have to be fantastic, but you've got to have the experience to do it. I said, I get about 5 to 10 emails of people saying, hey, I've re-edited one of your clips on the podcast, and 99.9% unfortunately are very, very poor. Like, they are trying to break through that door too soon, but they're actually not strong enough to break that door. Well, that's an interesting analogy. You've got to be strong enough to break down that door, but some people think they can too soon. That's an interesting way of thinking
about it. And you have to get your reps in first.
You have to get your reps in. You've got to get the muscle to break that door.
Bro, she can't
get
through it.
Yeah, there we go. I like this analogy. I'm writing this one down.
Yeah, take that. That's good.
I like this metaphor. And I think that's what's really, really important. And I would say, I think I am a really, really great example. And again, when I realized showreels don't mean anything anymore, but your social media page is your new showreel. And so I then thought, okay, what if I start a YouTube channel and an Instagram and Twitter where all I do is talk about editing? I talk about storytelling. I break down what these really great editing creative choices that I have made that people might not notice, but they probably felt. And because of that, I was in essentially now all of my pages on social media is essentially that's my showreel. That is my brand. Here's why you can trust me to edit your video. And I do see a lot of people do that. But again, I also see the similar thing where they start talking as if they do know everything, whereas I still clearly see them as developing editors or developing creators. And so again, same thing, you got to make sure that you can have the history to back up what you're saying. But you should definitely use your socials as your reel. That's your CV. That's your resume. So make sure you get it in your contracts to say, I can break down my creative choices in this and therefore share to everyone else why I'm proud of this video.
So you add that into your contracts?
I add that in my contracts now.
Wow, that's smart. And that's something really that at any level you should be kind of asking for.
I absolutely agree. If someone redlines that in my contract, I don't work for them. Because it's part of my brand. It's part of the reason why I continue getting more work is because, hey, I've edited for this creator. Here's something that I did. Now, the pushback on that, the understandable pushback, is you also have to be hyper aware of the choices that you made versus the choices and direction they made.
Yeah.
And so there have been creators that I've worked with where I think they have given me a lot of feedback. You know, like, of course, I'm not perfect. I'm never going to be able to knock it out right at the park right away. I got to understand their brand and their style a lot
their
more.
Tone of voice.
And so we do have that back and forth. But then, and it could be, they might have changed the story structure here, but I can't claim credit for that. But I know that this scene over here, they were actually really happy with and maybe just did a little bit clean up. I now know that I can talk about that sequence and I can talk and celebrate that.
So when you do something and get signed off by the creator and it was entirely you rather than a fed back kind of loop that you go through together, you know, that made it into the final cut and that was my decision.
Yes.
They signed off. Then you can say, cool, I'm going to use that and talk about it.
But if they gave feedback and potentially overhauled a scene and then I then say I edited and here's the creative choices I made, but no, actually that was the direction from them, then I shouldn't have permission to do that. I followed their direction rather than this sequence was mostly mine. And so you have to be conscious of essentially the creative ownership.
Yeah, and creative ethic of claiming that something is entirely yours and whatnot, but also the sensitivity to you being an editor for a client, how much is yours and so on. But I think if you can get that balance right, and if you just take the risk, because I think a lot of people are scared to claim anything or scared to talk about their work. And I'd imagine in the world of editing, knowing a lot of editors are typically quite introverted and maybe aren't as confident to be like, oh, that was actually something that I did. But once you do that, it can change the world for you.
Absolutely. I think you're right. A lot of editors are introverts and we're not quite capable or confident enough to kind of stand up for ourselves a little bit. But I think it's important that we can. And so we can say, here is something really cool that I created. Here's something really cool that I edited. And I think we don't have to be as scared as for the people that we work with. Yes, they've got the money, but they also care for you. There's a reason why they hired you. They like you. And so you can have these tough conversations. And actually, as I've been discovering the past 5 to 10 years, if you are able to have tough conversations with them sooner, they actually respect you. It's like, oh, shit. All right, we're talking about this now. Let's fucking go. And then actually you can kind of get a much more respectful working relationship with them. But if they accidentally, and I naively realize that they kind of can give them direction, you're not going to push back on some of these things, they can potentially be slightly bullying in the sense of, no, like, do this my way. But if you could actually push back on some things here and there, you can create a much better collaborative experience. It's still hard to really navigate it in the most mature way, but actually I've had better creative experiences when I've respectfully challenged some ideas or actually have said, hey, I actually want to be paid this amount. And then we actually have a much more respectful working relationship.
I was going to say, like, what are there any examples, without obviously going into too much detail, around a tough conversation? Like, what can, for an editor working at your level or as you were coming up and doing your thing, what can a tough conversation look like? And what are the common ones that people have to look out for?
I think one is probably, I think given my history, I am a huge proponent of ethics. Of, is this actually a good piece of content, or is this potentially controversial, or could it be bad for the creator? I think that's one of my huge things. I even have that in my contracts now as well, of I have the right to walk out from a project if I ethically disagree with it.
Wow.
But I think given my history, it's very important that I do that now. But that's me in my context. I think one of the biggest tough conversations is, how long is this going to take? I've been given tens of hundreds of hours of footage and they say, edit this in 20 days. And I say, no, I need 2 months. And I think a lot of editors, especially young editors with their youthful energy that I'm now envious of, I'm tired now. I can't do these things anymore, but they think, great, I can do this in 20 days. Fuck yeah, let's go. Day 18, they haven't said to them that the video is not ready yet. I think a lot of people make that mistake. And so I think being hyper aware of, this is not going to get done in the time frame that you're expecting. We have to talk about this. You're not going to get the quality that you expected because you only gave me 20 days to do this. We have to talk about this. You told me this can be done in 20 days. I looked at the footage and I now know I need 2 months. We have to talk about this now. Rather than potentially burning yourself out, exhausting yourself, and then potentially burning a bridge because you didn't say this can't be done in time sooner. And now you look bad because you didn't bring this up. It's okay to be professional, is what I think a lot of people are scared of. Or what they think being professional is delivering that in 20 days.
Doing whatever somebody says.
But then because that creator didn't have a good enough understanding of how long this is going to take, you've now delivered a bad product, a rushed product. And then they go, what the hell is this? And then they never work with you again. And then tell everyone else, hey, this is why you shouldn't work with this person. But actually, the amount of times, even for me, even my experience, I've given some of my editors some work. And I said, yeah, you can get this done in a week. And I encourage them, tell me if I'm wrong. And within 24 hours, they say, I feel like I need 2 weeks to do this. And I go, okay, how much is this going to cost? It's going to cost this amount. And I went, I think you're right. I think I severely underestimated this. All right, let's do 2 weeks.
And then you know you've got a good, trusting, working, collaborative, to your point, relationship.
Trust.
Whereas if you're just doing whatever anybody says to do in the time frames that they give you, when in reality they're unrealistic, you're going to burn yourself out, as you say. You're going to not deliver a good product, and ultimately your relationship's going to be destroyed with that person anyway.
Absolutely. I think even for me, I give someone a project and I probably was like loosely involved in the filming, or I probably might not have been aware of a technical issue that might set them back 4 or 5 days or something like that. But they would tell me. One of my favorite editors, he gives me an email every single day of what he got up to that day. I made this. I did this. I'm really proud of this decision. I had this technical issue which set me back 4 or 5 hours. But I was able to achieve this, and therefore I got this. I feel confident that we're on a decent timeline. And just those daily check-ins let me know what he was doing. And it gave me the perspective of, like, this is how much effort he's putting into this project. And then he was then able to then say, hey, Hayden, you've given me 2 months to edit this. I feel like we're going to need another 2 more weeks. Here is why. And I went, oh, yeah, I see this perspective. All right, you're approved for 2 more weeks on this. And I think it's because we're in this really weird... Now I'm on the other side of this. I'm getting this, okay, I have to spend as little money as possible because this is going to get expensive quickly. But I also want quality. But I'm working with someone that I can trust, says, you haven't given me enough time.
Yeah.
And now, because I trust him and he does fantastic output, I trust his decision that he needs more time. I don't say, fine, okay, we're going to have to spend a little bit of money doing this. And so I think I've had both experiences. I've not had enough time, but now I'm the one spending the money hiring these people, and I have to. And now I now understand. Now I'm on both sides. I have to find that middle place.
Yeah.
And so also, I would say, the main thing then is this: if you as a creator hire someone, and you don't give them enough time, and you probably don't pay them enough, that's not the editor's fault. I actually think that's the creator's fault.
Agreed.
You probably didn't give them good enough direction. What happens if you hire someone, you don't hear from them for 4 or 5 days, they send you something back and you go, what the fuck is this? well, that's your fault, not the editor's fault. You didn't give them good enough direction. If a project's not good enough, that's a creator's fault. If you didn't hire a talented editor enough because this person was cheaper, but they weren't capable of doing a good enough job, that's the creator's fault. If this editor felt scared to communicate their feelings about the project, that means you didn't create a healthy enough environment and they were intimidated by you. That's the creator's fault. I genuinely believe if projects stumble along the way, that is a responsibility of the creator or the client.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And there's a classic adage, right? People don't leave jobs, they leave managers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, to a point on bringing the professional corporate into this space, which is, I think, what this Creator Inc. needs.
Yeah.
When you're at that level, it's why we have a HR team at the Simon, all these things. It's that you would never think about 10 years ago. It's because those corporate structures are for a reason, and actually incentivization, proper incentivization, true kind of corporate trust, professional relationships, they need to break out from the, you know, the kind of somewhat erratic and chaotic kind of discord, youthful, sometimes has its place. But actually, as this stuff evolves, you're going to run into more problems than not unless you professionalize some of these things and build, as you say, a great relationship and a great trusting environment for your colleagues and employees.
I think we're having that maturing problem. It's, of course, this is YouTube, and so the branding is scrappy and dirty and cheap. That's outdated. That's not really the case anymore. Yeah, Simon Corporation is a great example. You've got a HR department. Do you have any idea how rare that is? I love that. Yes, a HR department. But I think we've got to give ourselves permission that we do need to grow up more in that sense. We need to mature more. But I think people just in that, probably that hustle culture thing, like, yeah, we do our management on Discord. It's like, just so they can say that they hustled in that way. It was like, that's not really particularly necessary, and you can grow out of that far quicker than I think you can realize. And I think giving ourselves permission to an extent, corporatize our workflow. That sounds scary. In fact, I hesitated saying that, but also I love that idea.
Yeah, and I think it's finding, it's to your point on bringing in the old and the new. It's like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
And try and run without taking the lessons of hundreds of years of corporate development and understanding of people, because ultimately all of people are the constant, relationships are the constant, and those things have never changed. And actually, if you take the best from this, what I always say with what we're trying to build, right, you take the best from the corporate world and you bring it into this incredible new medium and platform, then you're going to have an incredible result where you have the professional structures, people are looked after, they're supported, they're cared for, and they're incentivized, but you're also working in the most exciting frontier of media. But you're not going to make the mistakes you would make if you abandoned all of those corporate things.
But I'm now curious. So here's me. I'm becoming a manager.
Yeah.
In that sense, I've only really just learned this in the past year or two. What are the five things? What are the five mistakes you see new managers make, and how do you think they can be better?
Good question. So the first thing is to not incentivize properly. So having a lack of alignment with their employees, and by manager, I'll also put that into like managing director, CEO, any executive looking after a team. So number one is not incentivizing properly. People who are not aligning your great people with your bigger mission. Number two, I actually say, is around that bigger mission. So having having a bigger purpose and driving force.
I would say I want to get deeper on incentivization, because other people would consider that as a financial incentive.
Yeah.
But also, what about creative incentive? Like, how can you make sure that the content you're making is really enjoyable for the people that you're working with?
Yeah, and I'd say both of those things. But generally, incentivization and alignment are like maybe one and two.
Yeah.
Bringing people on a journey, giving them a mission and a vision that is bigger than themselves and bigger than you, and then paying them properly in alignment with that vision, and also setting those payment and that consideration in line with where you both want to get to. Using money as a tool to drive people, but being completely honest with yourself that people are not going to be bought into the family. People want to make money and they want to have a career that progresses. So I think I've seen so many times companies in the new media before this media, really, which go, you're part of the family, you're part of this journey. Like, you know, you're paid like 15 grand and you're working your ass off, but actually you're part of the bigger thing. And in reality, no, people are smarter now. So I think it's making sure people are well paid. Our big philosophy is pay less people much better, which honestly gets you, for me anyway, you get so much further than tons of junior staff that you're not paying and aligning properly.
Because if they're not paid enough and they're a genius, they're going to find the next best jobs.
Exactly, so, as they should.
Yeah, as they should, yes.
And you're responsible if they leave. Number three is micromanagement. And I think it's something which stifles people's feeling of trust, mainly. And the trust element is what gets you the best out of people.
Yeah.
So if you give people a good amount of trust and you give them freedom to exercise their brilliance, which is why you should be hiring them in the first place, then they should be doing a great job, and that will be reflected in the work and also them staying and being aligned and incentivized. Number four, I would say, is leading from the front, not behind. So I'm a big believer in, I don't know what your philosophy on that, but I'm a big believer in, you know, you bring people in to tell you what to do, not to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And if you're hiring well and you're bringing in exceptional people, you should be saying, well, what do you think? And helping, and then you are the curator of brilliance and excellence in other people, rather than being right, no, this is what we need to do.
Well, yeah, giving them the opportunity to say what they think is best for the content.
Exactly.
Giving them the opportunity, definitely with trust. But I think even for me, what I'm struggling with is that since I have had the experience to be able to figure out what is the best way of making this content, but then also giving them the opportunity to make these mistakes, but then also not then becoming a micromanager. Like, here's how I think the content can be, not should be, can be, and then giving them the opportunity to interpret it themselves.
Yeah.
But it's like that balance of giving them the lessons, but not micromanaging.
It's hard, and it's difficult when you're working on... I think editing is largely objective.
Yeah.
It's like, is this a good edit? Well, it's a pretty objective plane. It's not so much around, obviously there's injections of subjective humor and everything else, but you know when something's good and when something's not good. It's much easier to track that in what you do rather than in something maybe more creative rather than technical. Yours is a blend of the two. One of the best sort of HR advices, pieces of advice that I've ever seen or had was in Netflix's legendary kind of HR deck that completely triggered a lot of people because it was quite brutal, but it was also, I think, very fair. And one of the things that they said in that deck, which you can look up online, is, you know, you're a professional sports team and you as a manager are the coach of that team. And I think that mindset of, are the people good enough to be in the team? You're only as good as your weakest link. How do you help every person, every position get better at their job? That mindset changes management in just in a moment, because you go from being like, well, you're top down and you're telling the lemmings what to do, to being like, no, we are building this together. If we're going to win the league, we all need to be unbelievable. We need to show up to practice, we need to believe in the vision, and we need to work together. And my job as a coach, as a manager of a football team or whoever, is to get the best out of my team. And if it fails, I'm the one who gets fired, not the people on the pitch necessarily. So I think it's a really interesting way of looking at business, and it's definitely helped me to focus more from leading from the back rather than being like the guy up the front.
I think you're right, the manager has to be the supporter. They're not in terms of, they're the ones essentially probably carrying the weight to making sure that these guys can do their job.
Exactly.
Do you think, whereas I think if you're on top, like, hey, I'm the top dog, I'm the cool shit, all of you guys work for me, rather than, I think the best managers understand actually maybe a little bit at the bottom, and I'm working with them. I got to make sure they can do the job to the best of their ability.
100%.
And so I have to be the supporting. I have to be the foundation. But if I, as a manager, have got crap foundation, the entire thing collapses. 100%.
And what am I doing for you? How can I help you do a better job?
Yeah.
Not how can you, you know, I think it's a completely different mindset to traditional management, which is so top down. I'm the wise sort of God, if you will, lowercase g of this business, and I'm telling everyone what to do and they need to listen to me and be scared of me. That's traditional old school management. It fails. It doesn't work.
I think even I'm learning that. I think over the past couple of years has made me definitely develop that bit of an ego, and I am now beginning to unlearn that a little bit in terms of, like, actually they don't work for me, I work for them. And I have to make sure that it's my responsibility to make sure they have the best working environment where they can achieve the best ideas that they have for the content that we are making.
Yeah.
They're not making my content. We, as a team, are making content.
I think exactly that. And the minute that switch happens, and the minute you take a role as coach of a team of players and you're not even on the pitch, then you can really scale what you're doing. But also, I think I'm a big believer, and I say this to so many creators who are struggling with kind of that scaling pinch point of like, well, I'm managing all of this. I say the first thing is to hire somebody who can do that.
Yeah.
Get in an operator or a general manager type person, a CEO, managing director, who can run the ship, because I think creators need to be looking up, not down. Creators are creative, and mm-hmm. someone like yourself, you know, I say this to people like Max Fosh, whoever, Zach Alsop, all the time. It's like, you guys need to be looking up, not down. How do you look up? It's by bringing in somebody to run that operation, to run that ship. Otherwise, you will very quickly burn out. I would say the only reason why the Sidemen and how us as Arcade have been able to launch, have many different businesses and projects and ventures and different things beyond their content is because they have designated leaders running those businesses. When you have excellent people or partners driving those things operationally, the sky's your limit, I believe. If I was doing one of those things fully, I would fail on day one.
Mm-hmm. I agree on a lot of that. Yeah, I think... But coming back down to in the editing format, I think find those bosses. That's probably what it is. Find those bosses who understand that philosophy and then you stick with them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I stuck with Logan. I think he
gave me the trust, right?
He gave me trust and he incentivized me in terms of he gave me fantastic creative opportunities and that was one of the great incentives. What were the other five tenets? I want to see if they worked.
Oh, the other five pieces of advice. So it was incentivization, alignment.
Alignment. Me and Logan aligned so much in creativity and just and the opportunity. I agree.
Micromanagement.
No, I think it was he kind of trusted me to do whatever I wanted and then he'll come back and give me some feedback and some advice. We might fight a little bit here and there. But then that was pretty much it. He didn't micromanage.
And then I'd say trust.
Yeah.
Which sort of ties into what I was saying before, and then freedom.
And then freedom. And that's why I worked with Logan for 8 years.
People don't leave jobs, they leave managers. And that's why you didn't leave him.
Yeah, it took a long time. And then when the time came, it was because both me and Logan went, this is the natural opportunity for us to call it a day.
Yeah.
And the amount of times I've seen people fall out with the people they work with, no. Me and Logan just shook hands and went, all right.
Job done.
Thanks for everything.
In this box are a number of cards.
Uh-huh.
I would like you to pick out a card and read it out and tell me what comes to mind.
Okay. Logan Paul. I mean, but this is like 2016 Logan Paul. So this is when we're all very immature. So I'm getting some slight PTSD there, if I'm honest. but also gratefulness of like this... This is young Logan, and I see young me in that sense as well. And so I'm grateful of us growing up out of this. And so, but that's a young Logan. If there's old Logan, let's just see if we can get out of this. Okay. I think Mr. Beast, I think he has grown. He's made our industry grow up in many ways. But then also, I think I have and Jimmy knows this, a slight love-hate relationship with him in the sense that I think he unfortunately and unintentionally educated people to be over-editing. And like giving high retention things. And I think he's created a poor education on how to make good content. But even he is now fixing that. Some of his most recent videos have been really slower paced.
And doing much better.
And much better storytelling. And they're doing so well because of that. But it's because he's now learned to be a better storyteller. He doesn't have to over edit as much.
Mm.
When you over edit and you edit so fast, it's because actually your content's poor.
Yeah.
And so now that he knows how to make really, really great videos, he doesn't have to overcompensate with editing now.
Mm.
And he's letting these things breathe and people are saying, these videos are great. And so I love how he's made our industry grow up in terms of this is how big we can get. I've also resented how he's giving a lot of people the wrong lessons, but I also really respect that he's correcting that.
Mm.
And so, yeah.
I'd imagine you just fall... You don't necessarily intend to do that. You fall into, oh, this is working. This is getting views. This is, as we said, it's almost... It's kind of the kind of junk, like, easy access way of growth is to hack attention.
Yeah.
And then to grow up is to say, no, I'm going to go to a Michelin star restaurant. I'm going to refine what I'm doing, you know.
It's kind of like... I'm imagining... Mr. Beast's McDonald's and rebranding saying, hey, let me give you a gourmet steak.
Right.
That's what I'm getting out of it now. It's like, what a fast, imagine McDonald's started doing like Michelin food. Hell yeah.
I'm down. That's it.
I love that idea. Adobe adds plenty of AI wizardry to Photoshop and Premiere. Now, I think we're going to be okay with AI. It's going to be the edit assistant's edit assistant. Is it going to take over creativity? Absolutely not. Because all AI can do is learn what's already existed, and it's incapable of thinking of something new, and because all of us as editors will all edit something completely differently, each our own individuality, why are we expecting AI to replicate ourselves when all of us are unique anyway? So I think it's going to be a really, really good edit assistant. It's going to make us do tasks that we, none of us want to do, such as talking
heads. The line
heads,
cut.
Like cutting out all of those pieces of silence.
Yeah,
it is,
yeah.
Oh, we have to find a soundbite from something. So we, now we've got AI transcriptions to help us find that soundbite that we've been looking for. All of the brute force stuff that none of us want to do, it's going to do that, which means we're going to be creative sooner. And so, yes, be slightly intimidated by AI, but it's not going to hit the quality that we're scared that it's going to hit. Mm. There's going to be a limit at some point. We don't know when that is. In the next 3, 4, 5 years, it's going to hit a limit and we're going to go, okay, this wasn't as bad as we thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, agreed. And also, I think to the point we said earlier, it will increase the efficiency of creative people to get rid of the boring stuff to allow them to be more creative. So the quality will actually, as we know, go up and that'll just set the bar higher and people will need to be better, ultimately.
The best example I always give is when we interviewed the editors of The Last of Us. One of our favorite videos on the channel. But the main editor, Timothy, talked about how his assistant editor, once she kind of did a lot of the brute force stuff, she was kind of twiddling her thumbs a little bit. And so Tim went, hey, why don't you go edit this scene then? And she did. And she did this and she did this. And she was really, really good that she got co-editing credit on the show. Oh. And what that then meant is that I like this idea of if she had the AI support system that meant that she then suddenly had time to then edit a couple scenes because she then had the opportunity to do so, she wasn't able to get that experience and then become potentially main editor for the next season because of that.
Yeah.
Her opportunities are going to be a lot more accessible sooner because she had the support of an AI system giving her that time back.
Mm, yeah.
And I like that. That's exciting me. We can be creative sooner because of AI.
And again, to the point we said earlier, probably the fundamental overarching principle of everything that you've said, you have to be good.
Yeah.
And she was good enough to get the shot, to take the opportunity as you did. Mm-hmm. She took it and then she excelled as a result. But that is the fundamental thing. AI and everything else will just weed out more of the bad editors and leave room for those who are great.
Absolutely. AI can create more opportunity and that excites me. And CapCut. I guess you're expecting me to hate on this, but honestly, no. I wish I had CapCut when I first started being a filmmaker. My first editing software was Windows Movie Maker. But let's also take note that I'm mentioning it as your first editing software. This is your entry-level software now. This is where you get started. This is where you first discover editing. But then over time, you're going to hit its limitations. You're going to get a bit tired of all the templates it gives you. You're going to start going, well, actually, I want to do a little bit more of this myself rather than this thing guiding me and making all of my decisions for me. And then you graduate to Adobe Premiere. You then graduate to DaVinci Resolve. You then graduate to Avid, maybe. You know, it's like this is a really great entry-level piece of software, and then you're going to graduate from it.
Mm. Yeah. What do you use?
I actually use Final Cut Pro X, but I know it's not really relevant anymore. I'm just being a little bit old about that in the same way that people older than me are stuck to Avid. But I also do use Premiere Pro and DaVinci Resolve. I'm able to use all of them, basically.
Yeah. I mean, if you were starting out, what would you say to somebody other than maybe CapCut, if you were to kind of graduate from CapCut and you're like, right, I want to take this seriously, what would you say to use? Or is that a pretty tricky question?
I would say Premiere Pro. I think Premiere Pro is... I think it just needed a little bit. It needed past couple of years to kind of stabilize, and it doesn't really crash anymore. The stereotype of Premiere Pro crashing is not really a thing anymore. I would say it is getting good enough that it always has been good enough for you to then do massive projects. Its collaboration has gotten significantly better. I think most high production people are using its cloud production software where. You can be, its collaboration is really great. It's team projects and things like that. That's really great. And so it's getting more and more better by the year. And Adobe listens and it takes feedback really, really well. And so I think, and especially Premiere Pro won their first Oscar with Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Was that all edited on Premiere?
It's all edited in Premiere Pro.
When most of us edited on Avid, right?
Most things are still edited on Avid. And wow. So Premiere Pro, we're moving into Premiere Pro's time. Now, that doesn't mean that we should neglect DaVinci Resolve. That also has its own powerhouse things. One of the smart things that they're doing is that their base software is for free. And so right now, those two are competing with each other for the main space. However, though, we just talked about CapCut. Adobe Premiere Pro, last time I checked, has between 8 to maybe 20 million users, if I remember correctly, whereas CapCut has 300 million. But that is also new filmmakers. People have probably downloaded CapCut once and probably haven't opened it since. And so we also need to question the validity of that number. Yeah, but yeah. I think...
It's a lot still. Even
still
if
a lot.
Halve it. Still a lot. Yeah.
It's still a lot. But you still can't really edit... you can't edit a Mr. Beast video on CapCut. It's not possible. But you can on Adobe Premiere Pro and you can on DaVinci. And when people want to start moving towards better quality, I can't edit a Logan Paul video on CapCut, but I can on Premiere, I can on DaVinci, I can on Final Cut. And so, yeah, Premiere Pro is the one that I'm betting on, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah, love it. Right, thank you very much for the box. I've got one last question for you.
Hit me.
Going back to your 17-year-old self, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give to them?
When you fail, don't lash out. That's the advice I am always giving myself today, and something I wish I knew sooner. You don't know everything. Everyone has a different perspective and everyone has a different idea, and as long as you're willing to listen and you're willing to collaborate, you will always make the best content. And I think that's kind of maybe the advice I wish I gave to myself earlier on of, yeah, you might have identified that this interest is going to grow, but if you weren't so much of a dick about it, you'd be in a much better place today.
Yeah.
I'm still in a great place now, but I think if I wasn't so much of an arsehole here and there, I'd probably be in a much better place.
I couldn't agree more. I'm not about you. I couldn't agree more about myself. I've been there. Yeah. I think that's super wise advice for anyone, because you definitely don't know it all, and you don't need to. That's the thing. I think we feel like we have to prove ourselves when we're young and we're moving quickly.
Yeah.
But you don't need to. Love it. I think that's a great place to end. We could talk all day, bro. That was amazing. Thank you so much for coming on.
Great, thank you so much. Yeah, that was excellent. That was really fun.
Love it. I want to go and edit now. I want to get Premiere Pro after speaking with Hayden for an hour. I want to just start editing today because that was phenomenal. I'm so inspired by that. And I think for any of us who are working in the business of entertainment and content, learning how to tell stories is the fundamental skill. Learning how to edit is an even greater technical ability, which basically brings together all of the elements of filmmaking into one. And Hayden articulated that, I think, so well today. Hopefully, if you're at home and you are looking to become an editor yourself, to really make that your business in whatever capacity that means, then this episode has given you something of value. And I'm sure it has. So thank you for watching. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Share this to your editor friends. And we'll be back for another episode of Unbox next week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.